A Taste for Murder is a game about murder. You and a group of friends play the residents of a 1930s English country house. One of you will die. All of you will uncover secrets. And at the end, one of you will be exposed as the murderer. I'm Epistory Richard, co-organizer of the London Indie RPG Meetup Group.
My name is Robert Cannell, and I am an RPG zine editor and non-award-winning game designer.
A Taste for Murder is designed by Graham Walmsley, and he is certainly, I mean, we've talked previously about Ben Robbins and his overall, and him as a designer who has a body of work as opposed to... Yeah, a corpus, exactly. And Graham, I think, is very much in the same bracket. He's not a designer who's coming in and saying, you know, this is my one game, this is my one idea. You know, he's been around the RPG landscape for, I don't know, at least 20 years or so. He's put out several different games, and he's...
And he crosses genres as well. He's not exclusively a story gamer. He's also a traditional RPG writer as well.
Yeah, and before that, he was a LARPer. Now he's getting more and more interested in UK freeform LARP. And he also has a couple of Ennies to his credit as well. And I think that this is one of his most enjoyable games to talk about, partly because it's a good game in its own right. And he himself has posted that he's been surprised about how well it's gone down, but also because it's a game which, when you read through the game, you have a look at how it's designed, you understand how every bit of it makes sense. So in many of the games we've spoken about, with particular mechanics where we're like, well, this is maybe what they're trying to achieve with that, or it's not quite sure, and we're not quite sure about the intent of this particular thing. This is really, really clear. Everything in there, it's a game that's been built from the ground up. Everything in there, you can absolutely see what the purpose is. But equally, it's a snapshot of this particular designer in his own arc of development. And I think, I mean, I don't know, I've never spoken to him about this topic. I think if he was to sit down and make the same game today, he would do it very differently. In terms of why we're talking about this game in the first place, we have a very notable designer who not only written games, but also wrote Stealing Cthulhu, wrote Play Unsafe as well. And we also have a game that is one that is a really interesting game and pull apart to see how it works. And it does fundamentally work. So A Taste for Murder is your quintessential 1930s English country manor murder mystery game. You have a selection of different characters, all of whom relatively either emotionless or melodramatic. There will be a murder halfway through, and the villain and the culprit will be revealed at the end of it. But all the while, they're with this veneer of polite society and respectability, while at the same time, a huge roiling emotions and deceit and darkness that's going underneath.
The usual.
The usual, yeah. And it's also unusual in that it's a investigative game. It's a murder mystery game, which is GM-less, where we have the vast majority of investigative games out there, typically in your kind of Call of Cthulhu bent, are all ones that have a GM or a keeper or at least some person who's there portraying the world.
So do you think the primary purpose of this game is to recreate that 1930s murder in the mansion genre, or is there other intent behind it?
It's absolutely...
Because you mentioned the darkness.
Yeah, so it's absolutely about recreating that genre. It's not about recreating the mystery themselves, because... And this is where I think the design takes a really interesting turn. Your quintessential Agatha Christie mystery not only includes people's motivations, but also includes a lot of evidential investigation. People look for, oh, it's the footprint in the soil outside the window, or it's the blood on the handkerchief, or that kind of thing. Yeah. But here, the designer's chosen to solely focus on motivation. Mm. And really, all the other things that you would normally include and would actually be at the forefront in most murder mysteries around opportunity, around means, are all afterthoughts. Mm. Is that they're all there basically paying service to the overriding important factor, which is motivation. That the games you have out of it are not perfectly in line with your Miss Marple or your Poirot kind of like strong investigator role who then encounters this kind of battery of bizarre characters. It doesn't entirely, but it almost exercises that strong investigator role entirely and really allows it to be a portrait of the messed up familial style relations of what would normally be like the secondary cast.
For me, Poirot's, you mentioned Poirot there, and Poirot is kind of very much the touchstone when I think about what is this trying to do, because I always feel that Poirot doesn't really do much detecting of anything. It's like, after there's a murder, it then seems to be about half an hour of people sitting around in a very pleasant room while Poirot explains things about them and about their relationships, and then draws from, you know, having exposed them all for what they really are, then seems to pull out of the hat the fact that one of them murdered someone, you know. But I think there's a weird interpretation of Poirot where he's some kind of...
psychic?
not psychic, no, but, you know, pulling apart everything, you know, like a nihilist. Poirot the Nihilist, you know, showing that, and this is one aspect I think that comes out in the gameplay that I want to come back to, is like this idea that everything is worthless.
Everyone has a dark side. Everybody has secrets. And that is absolutely where this particular game eats, on the premise that nobody's innocent. Everybody is guilty of something. Everybody has a dark secret about them, but it's just some people have even more dark secrets about them than others.
Let's get mechanical for a second. Let's get into some of the nuts and bolts, because you all mentioned it's a game of two halves with a murder in the middle. So in the first half, we kick off the game by inventing some characters, and there's no like kind of fixed playset, right? We're free as players to start suggesting things and throwing things around, but the idea is that the whole story is constrained almost literally into a country house or a, you know, stately manor or something.
Yeah, exactly that. So the first half is all about the establishment of character, and really to start, the first half is really just a preamble. It's a tremendously enjoyable preamble. Each of the halves is built around a group scene and a series of side scenes. So the group scene has every character in, and then one by one, characters pull other characters off into individual side scenes. And in each side scene, there always has to be the one character who initiated it is trying to influence the other character to do something. At the very basic level, the first half will always give you an ensemble of characters who all want something.
There's the group scene, which is about the kind of effectively the public face that all the characters are wearing and what they show to one another.
Yeah.
And then in the side scenes, the person who initiates the scene then shows their private face, right? Which is, I would say, more aggressive and...
Certainly more manipulative. Yeah.
Okay. And then what are the kind of mechanics around the resolution of that influence attempt?
Yeah, so everybody has a... And this is where it has its kind of old-school influences. Every character has a dice pool on their relationship with another character. And so when it comes to decide whether or not their attempt to influence succeeds, everybody rolls their dice against the target character. And the target character rolls their dice against the person trying to influence them. And there are a couple of additional die that can come into play, which I'll mention later. But it's then whoever rolls the highest single number on their die gets to choose whether or not the attempt to influence succeeds. What is the end result of, you know, have two rounds of going around this? What is the end result of all that is you have everybody wanting something or several things from everybody else. So you have all these desires that have either failed, they've been thwarted, in which case they may wish to have revenge against the person who's denied them, or alternatively they succeeded, in which case the person who is the target may wish to gain some kind of retribution for the thing they've been given up, or somebody else who's been slighted in some way. As I say, it's the genre itself has a bigger role for the detective figure, but here it's almost as though the detective has been taken out. And so
yes, because that is quite interesting, because the detective is not there in the first half of the game, which leads on to the kind of the midpoint, I think. So there's two rounds of going around and establishing
motivations
and possible reasons that people would get murdered, and then someone does get murdered.
Yeah, so that's done on a voting system. So everyone writes down the person who they think would be the most interesting person for the interesting character for them to die, and then those ones are shuffled, and then one is picked at random. So it's not flat out voting like you do in like microscope scene resolution. It's rather that if there is one favoured target, then they're just more likely to be picked as opposed to definitely be picked because two people said they should be. And then after that, that player in the time-honoured traditions of murder mysteries everywhere then becomes the inspector, becomes Inspector Chapel, who arrives and then gets the chance to describe how their former character was killed and where they were found and so forth. And then you enter the second half of the game, and it stops becoming about trying to influence each other so much as it becomes trying to investigate people's motivations for killing the victim.
So I'll tell you something that Taste for Murder has in common with Fiasco, its stable year mate, and that is that they are both games where I enjoy one half a lot more than the other half. And it's really interesting up until the point that Inspector Chapel appears.
Right.
And I think it's a really nice switch. It's like, mechanically, it's the most interesting thing in the game for me, this switch. But after that second half, it's going into these investigation scenes, which, unlike the first half, aren't time limited. It's not two rounds and we're going to decide who is revealed. Now...
No, there is an end condition. So each of the investigation scenes is if you succeed in your investigation the same way that you... the same way with influencing someone, then the target has to fill in a level from their motive sheet. So their motive sheet is split into three levels. The first, right at the top, you say what your basic relationship is with the victim. Then the next level, you say, but secretly, and then there's a gap for you to fill in when you are investigated successfully the first time. Then there's a second level to say, and to make it worse. And then there's third level, which is and the horrific truth is, or words to that effect. And so when you're successfully investigated, you have to add a deeper and darker layer to your potential your motivation to potentially killing them. And then when you have two people at that level, then you go into your end game mechanics and you work out which one of those two is the actual killer. And they get a chance to throw themselves on the mercy of the court or to declare why the bastard deserved it all along, and then the game is done.
Which is much more in genre.
Yeah,
like the confession in the face of the flimsiest evidence is the perfect conclusion. And it's this... It just feels like this investigation phase. It's a kind of recapitulation of the first part of the game, but for me, much less enjoyable.
Because the second half is actually where I enjoy it the most, because the first half, for me, is kind of light, kind of just a bit wishy-washy. You're starting to lay down a few interesting ideas for where you might go, but in the second half, that's where the meat of the game is, because everybody's plumbing the potential depths of their character. Everybody's taking off their polite mask and getting into how this otherwise genteel relationship with their father figure, the groundsman, their American cousin or whomever has actually is in reality a kind of a far more twisted and horrific parody of the apparent relationship.
And this for me is where it starts coming off genre. Right, and it becomes its own thing. Because I feel the first half is very Miss Marple, Agatha Christie. Like you say, it's light-hearted, and there's insinuations of the deeper problems that are running through the group. But when you start getting into investigations, I think that the motives with the three different levels of secret that essentially build... I think they're meant to build on one another.
Yeah.
But where you end up is the natural tendency to want to top the previous thing. And therefore, I think mechanically this is one of the key flaws in the game for me, because the first thing that you reveal in the motivation actually defines the tone for the rest of the investigation. So it's a very critical thing. So if you say a character, you know, has a relationship of being a loving brother, but actually is the uncle of the victim or whatever, then you can very rapidly take a trip into darkness that isn't genre appropriate anymore. It's usually, I would say, in the genre, it's like, yes, people are being murdered And some of the Christie stories are dark stories about abandoned children or actually fake identities because someone has murdered the actual person before the story even began. You know, so the character they're presenting is completely false. But in general, it's like, it's a little bit roguish and it's a little bit caddish. I think that's the key thing. It's caddish. What Taste for Murder does in its second half, and I think it's the crux of what it is, I feel it says that everything is rotten and dark, and the natural tendency of the game is to create something, as you say, that is horrific, and all the characters are dislikable. You know, there's almost no hope for humanity at the end. That feels to me like a much bigger, harsher statement than its source material.
Okay.
But you love it.
I love the mechanics of it, and I love its ability. And this is, and we're getting on to whether or not, and we're already talking about whether or not it succeeds in the goal it's trying to get to. But I think we should mention very briefly about where the game is coming from in terms of its design. So where it's kind of drawing its ideas from. And obviously with this one, we're always speculating because we don't have, unless they've written a section saying, well, unless the designer's written a section saying, well, I took this from this and this from the other.
And thank you to all those designers who do, because it makes the job a lot
makes
easier.
Makes the job a lot easier, yeah. to draw our kind of game family trees. The most classic part of this game that most resembles a more traditional role-playing game are the relationship dice. So this concept of dice pools that have been well used in a variety of other kind of mainly D20 games before then. But beyond that, everything else looks quite different. And it's ones where I struggle to see the antecedents in terms of design. And what I think instead is that there are the two extra dice, the white die and the black die, which I mentioned earlier, but I'll go into more detail now. So these are placed upon essentially wheels of emotions or actions. And those dice are awarded to the character who is best presented that particular kind of emotional state. So if one of the aspects of the wheel was heartbroken, for example, if you play your character in the side scene in a heartbroken way or a bloodthirsty way or an angry way or whatever, you get to pick up the dice and include that die, that white die or that black die in your roll, and then it gets moved around in order that different emotional states are presented. And that strikes me as classic improvisation. And of course, the designer is famous for writing Play on Safe, which is taking kind of the works of Keith Johnston and translating it into a gaming environment, and obviously has a lot of experience in improvisation. And so that, I think, is where that particular strand goes from, is that he's saying, how can we break out of the relatively solid or stodgy kind of English reserve? The way I'm going to do it, I'm going to give a mechanical benefit to these people, to anybody who actually presents this particular emotional state. And in terms of the motivations, the different levels, he also wrote Stealing Cthulhu and he wrote Cthulhu Dark. And so this strikes me as, this is classic Cthulhu thinking, is that you have an initial, this is what the evil appears to be, but actually it's even worse than that. Actually, the true horror, when you finally get to it, is finally revealed as a big gribbly thing with tentacles that's going to kind of drive you insane. So it's not the same as Cthulhu, but I see that as being...
No, I think that's a really sensible comparison, because that also strikes to my objection with it. Is that it...
I've fallen into your trap.
Is that it's a game of Miss Marple that suddenly, you know, like has a nice twist, and there's a murder, and then suddenly descends into the nihilistic embrace of Nahlatep via, you know, sex parties,
you're saying it's
human hunting.
Agatha Cthulhu, aren't you?
Yeah, pretty much. And that maybe reflects the interests of the designer. But then, for me... leaves it, if the goal is to be Miss Marple, to be Agatha Christie, then the second half doesn't work.
So there's one final thing I want to mention before we conclude on whether or not it works in terms of... because we're going all over the place with film, is that in terms of the things that they're in the game in order to accomplish it, and this is the fact that this game book, A Taste for Murder, is the closest indie game that I've seen that is like a traditional role-playing game in the sense of the way the book itself is laid out. Because in your classic role-playing game, you get the rules at the beginning in the first half, and then in the second half, you get all the background. You get all the giant amount of background that's all that will tell you all about how to play in this particular universe of D&D or Traveller or Pathfinder or what have you. And A Taste for Murder is exactly the same as that, apart from the fact it's an indie game with kind of indie game mechanics. So in the first half, you get all the mechanics that you need in order to play the game, right? And in the second half, there are pages and pages and pages of beautifully written background all about what life was like in the 1930s stately homes, including the different types of roles, the kind of people who were there, the different kind of occupations they had, even down to the point of recipes for these certain like traditional dishes. This is something that you can easily ignore when you're prepping the game, but actually you do so at your loss. Because that is all about trying to guide people into the correct kind of play in order to emulate the kind of society. And that inclusion is really useful, and all this stuff is in there in order not to say these are not mechanical requirements, but this is just the background to immerse yourself in so that you can, if you are not already conversant with this kind of genre, is that you can at least get all this kind of information in order that you can have a stab at playing into it, no matter where you are in the world.
But arguably it would be stronger to not have that as background material, but to have it embedded into the rules if it matters, right? And the truth is that if we were to strip away all the trappings of Taste for Murder, what we're left mechanically with is two rounds of
freeform roleplay in order to establish a certain network of desires and needs,
which, as you say, is defined by six possible options of a emotion dice.
Not defined by.
They're encouraged by.
You're encouraged to explore different aspects of your character by getting a mechanical reward from it.
Followed by a murder that is based on lot. Followed by the only choice, really, that you have in the second half of the game is who are you going to try and fit up for the murder. That is all you can do. The rest of it is colour. And if you take that bare-bone structure, then there's nothing about this, the death of Edwardian society. I mean, it could work in lots of different contexts. And in fact, it would work better, arguably, as, say, an urban crime drama, where there's a crime gang, and then someone gets murdered, and it turns out that, everyone is double-dealing and betraying one another.
Or kind of a Game of Thrones style thing where there are certain characters in there who always seem to have like deeper and deeper motivations, and it's possible to tell which way they go. But I think that this is actually the mechanics, I think, are really clear when you read through it, and it all fundamentally works together. It's all relatively cohesive. It's not.
Yeah, it is cohesive as design, but it's not.
What you're saying is the mechanics are not specific enough for this particular genre. But what I would say,
they're not supportive. There's not an interplay between the mechanics and the concept.
What I'd say to that is that these mechanics don't support things like combat. Because, and there is no combat in the genre. There are no thrilling chases or escapades or stuff like that. It is, as you say, about people in rooms talking, primarily. And it's about the revelation of increasingly darker secrets about everything, which is exactly what this game provides. And now, one of the problems that does encounter with play, and it comes out relatively often in this game, is one where, as you say, people try to top each other. And so they go off the reservation, they go outside of the genre in order to bring in all sorts of bizarre and wonderful and gonzo things into their explanations, because they started off quite strong for their first, and their secret is, and then they have to top it, and they do, and they go beyond like the initial confines of their starting motivation.
And so I think there are failings in the mechanics there. I think there are failings to set limitation or to even set reasonable expectations in the player of how important that first revelation is. And secondly, to try and put some boundaries. And essentially, I think what is required is that the second and third revelation build on the first, but shouldn't fundamentally change it unless at the end it's an inversion. This is a platform into which players make it work or don't. And I think compared to some of the games that we've been discussing, that is not true for them. But I think it's very true here, is that this is a game of what you make it, because the fundamentals aren't deeply connected to its concept.
For me, I mean, what I look for in GMless games is that it provides some kind of start to it, which it does in this case. It says, you are going to be in this kind of setting, you're going to be in a stately home, and you're going to be these kind of characters, and you get to develop your relationships between you. The next thing I look for in a GMless game is a sense of structure through it, because otherwise your game can go absolutely anywhere without any kind of rhyme or reason. It's kind of desperately difficult to try and stop it. And this game provides a structure. And what I also look for it to do is to do something which is appropriate for the genre, to say, why is this game good at supporting this type of story as opposed to like any other kind of story? And this one around the revelation of greater and deeper, darker secrets around the ensemble of suspects is one that I think absolutely keys into the basic genre, where secrets and lies are stripped away. And I take your point around the maybe the guidance in the second half of the game is not strong enough to say that these things should be building upon each other, and there should be kind of constraints in there, which I actually think players would appreciate, because coming up with more and more deeper and darker revelations after the first one can be a struggle, which leads to increasingly gonzo things. But this fundamentally is absolutely in the genre. So this for me ticks an awful lot of those boxes for what I expect from a yeah. solid GMless game.
I feel differently about the nature of the genre and the reveal, but I will take the rest of it on board.
What I would say is that the dice pools are just unnecessary. Is that I understand why they're put in there. The addition of the white and the black die are cool extras and help push different kinds of play. But the fundamental thing of you go into a side scene with somebody and then you have to roll. Everybody has to roll dice. I mean, it's some people like rolling dice, and I don't want to take that away from them. But it's just not needed, because the odds are such that you will normally succeed. And to be honest, even if you don't succeed, it's all you're doing is making things a little bit harder or easier for characters, like within the end game. Whereas actually, in the end game, you want to have these different levels come out as soon as possible. And the possibilities of failures are just not interesting. There's not a proper kind of fail-forward mechanic in there. In terms of what, I mean, I get out of this game, like whether or not it's kind of a joyful pleasure, or there's a different kind of experience. I mean, for me, it's a joy, much like Vast and Starlit. It's about being able to create a story within this particular genre, which is very well loved. I mean, is it the same thing for you? Or
I kind of quite like the genre. And like I said, I enjoy the first half of the game, and I think if there was a different end game mechanic, and it could be one of two ways. It could have either... I feel the genre requires a red herring and a culprit, rather than every, you know, spraying the shit cannon across everyone on the scene.
I must have missed that, the Christine movie.
That's my point, right? That's what the game does. And I've failed to see that Agatha Christie movie. And it doesn't... And it can't lead to interesting things like the Murder on the Orient Express, where everyone...
Oh, spoiler. Spoiler alert.
The butler what done it.
Oh, dear.
It can't lead to the more interesting outcomes of some of the books. And to be honest, it just goes on too long. It outstays its welcome for me. Like, I enjoy it, and then it feels like a grind. It's like a game that kind of collapses for me into being a chore, ultimately.
So is there anything that we can take from this game that would be anything that we think has contributed to the ongoing conversation around RPG design, or anything that designers should take from it? And as I say, for me, the dice pools are something which is well understood. The hand signals are nice. I quite like, and I would like to have in more of my games, ones where it's really clear what mechanic people are trying to activate, and doing it in such a way that it doesn't break the flow.
The mechanic that I think is really powerful in this game, and is kind of unique, is the one where the murdered character's player switches from being a player that is more or less equal, the same as the other players, to having a different game role and a different set of game in-game powers, which differentiates them from the other players. So their previous character becomes a victim and essentially becomes part of the background and an object. But then the player themselves is a new driving force in the game that emphasizes the switch from the first half to the new motivation in the second half. And, you know, I've iterated my problems. I think there would be a stronger way for that player to kind of drive towards the conclusion we want. But I think the basic idea of players changing roles at some pivotal point in the game, but the rules being simple enough that they can switch from one mode of game interaction to another mode of game interaction, is really strong. I think the change in status of one of the players around the table invokes a different atmosphere in the game. And that first round when Inspector Chapel arrives and starts questioning people, I think that is the moment that, you know, that's the moment when I think, oh, this is a good game. And then the second time, like, my happiness with the game kind of diminishes from that point. But I think that flipping point is really interesting. And there may be games that change roles, but not in ways that define the game.
Not in the ways that
this game
such life, yeah. or so change the yeah. so change the narrative.
The dynamic, yeah. Essentially, the player dynamic. It uses it's the metagame around the player dynamic changes.
And it does it without having to do an awful lot of metagaming around it. It all flows as part of the story.
Yeah.
It more reminds me of, rather than the Agatha Christie books, where Poirot and Miss Marple are well-defined characters in their own right. It rather reminds me more of an Inspector Calls, which is a play by J.B. Priestley, where the inspector itself is one of where the light is entirely thrown upon the secrets within this one particular family, and the inspector himself is a character who almost has no existence outside of the play for the amount of background that his character is given. We kind of get on to whether or not the game should be part of the canon. And before you get into it, because I am going
to be fascinated to hear what is going to come next. I feel you have a mountain to climb.
I know where you're going to fall on this one. But let me put this to you: the canon that we are essentially curating as part of these conversations is one where we are broadly coming down to games where we believe are the most effective at delivering their particular goals and are most cohesive around the performance of those goals. What other game out there is an improvisational, GM-less murder mystery, one where you do not start with the adventure relatively either entirely mapped out or with a clear spine of it mapped out? Is this not the preeminent murder mystery GM-less role-playing game?
I think what you're doing there is confusing uniqueness with worthiness. I would agree that in its field, it's very small. And, you know, don't oversell this idea of the mystery being built up out of nothing. Because, you know, I've gone over the reasons why I think that you only investigate the motivations, and there isn't enough structure to make those motivations coherent. And as many times as playing as not, they're going to be very incoherent and completely over the top and extreme and not plausible and not in genre. So, yes, it's a small field, and, you know, I might be struggling to say that it's a field of one, but don't confuse uniqueness with the fact that it deserves a place as an epitome, I think, really, is what a canon is, the epitome. Is this game a free-form murder mystery game? Yes. Is it the epitome of that concept? No, it's just a starting place, and there is there's a refinement of this very rule system that I think would be more enjoyable and get closer to the experience. But I genuinely think there's a better way to approach this problem. It's a pointer to how you can do a mystery, but the mysteries that are revealed are often very unsatisfying. And, you know, a good mystery novel isn't unsatisfying in that way because it gets refined. And it's not to say that conventional reveal plots aren't equally unsatisfactory, but, you know, the responsibility is quite clear.
but the point you make around that, where you have a murder mystery, is that these are books that you, a well-written murder mystery, you should be able to read twice. But for this one, is that you can't go back and or play through it again, or read, or go back through the story again and go, oh, if only I knew that really he was the adopted son of the third cousin of the Viscount Cranbourne, and that he was a secret agent from the Bolsheviks in order to take down,
because
all the clues were there, you know.
Yes, that's the whole point, right? Is that it completely lacks that whole clues and precedence aspect. So I always feel that this is a game that is like circling around an expression. You know, like I would say, it's a game of circling around genteel darkness. People want things in the first half of the game, and things get twisted, but then they get twisted and warped again, and they get twisted and twisted and twisted in a way that isn't just a simple reinterpretation of the initial occurrence. It's far more profound, and in many ways lurid and ridiculous.
So we've spoken about A Taste of Murder, which is a quintessentially British game, a game which is set within a fundamentally British kind of environment. Another game that is also by a British designer and also plays upon these concepts of deeper and darker secrets is Witch, The Road to Lindisfarne, which is a more spiritual successor to Monsieur 1244, but it is essentially takes the Nicolas Cage movie, Season of the Witch, and puts it into a role-playing game so you can make a story which is far better than the Nicolas Cage movie, Season of the Witch.
Is that hard?
It's not desperately hard, no. It's structured freeform, but yet it is completely railroaded. And oddly enough, that railroad is the best thing about it.
I'm going to admit that I've never played Witch, which is kind of...
Heretic!
Which, yes, would lead me to be burned.
Which, considering it's been, considering it was launched at IndieMe, considering that you are friends with people who espouse it so vociferously, means that it's not just happened to be the case that you haven't had a chance to play it yet, it's that you've specifically avoided it.
I seem to have done everything in my power to avoid playing it, and I have blanked the launch party from my memory. I can honestly not really remember being there. I have a copy of it, so clearly at some point I encountered it.
Well, let's put you in a cage, put you on a cart, and take you to Lindisfarne.